The reality is a client who needs working capital is better served with a more curated product that meets their needs. I think the hope for AI is that you'd be able to scale at such an accelerated pace. You're obsessed with getting things perfect. Let the market define perfect.
Welcome back to The Breakout CEO, everybody. I'm Jeff Holman, your host with Intellectual Strategies, and glad to be back with you guys again today. And I'm really glad that we've got Lou Rosabianca. Did I say that right, Lou?
Perfect.
Awesome. Got Lou here. I was on their podcast, Lou and Matt's podcast, a while back, and we just had such a good time. When I started my podcast, I'm like, man, I need to have these guys on. It'll be a good conversation. Mostly because you and Matt bring such good energy and character to the show. But thank you for coming on the show today.
Jeff, thank you for having me. It's easy to have that energy because we like what we do. And we're in the small business space. We offer lending and tax credits to the small businesses of America. And it's just a wonderful time to be in this industry, because you have to think outside the box. No 2 days are the same, and every day brings a ton of challenges out there. And small business is vibrant. Irregardless of what you hear and say in the news, American business is thriving, and we see it on a daily basis.
Yeah, I love that. And that you use a different word than I use. You said it's vibrant. I believe that's absolutely true. I like to call it chaotic, and maybe I need to change my verbiage.
No, it's chaotic chaos. Vibrancy.
Yes, it's both. It's a full energy chaos, but it's great. And we'll get into some of that because I know you've worked with a lot of businesses. You've grown your own business. You've seen and experienced the breakout moments. And I want to get into that with you. But before we go there, I love to ask some of my guests, you know, an initial question to kick things off. And that is, you're busy. You're building your business. You've got, you know, partners. You've got clients. You've got everything outside of business in your life. You know, it's a lot to carry, especially when you're the CEO of the business or you're in a role that's very demanding. I'd love to know, you know, what is it that drives you or motivates you from day to day? When you get up in the morning, you know, maybe it's what you already said. Maybe it's that vibrant community. But what is it that drives you and motivates you from day to day?
I'd like to come up with some sort of philosophically high-minded notion, but I'm too practical to say that. And I think the core drive for me comes back to my childhood. I'm first generation immigrant parents, and I was raised and inculcated with that idea of having to strive and thrive and grow and assimilate and become American and become successful. And there was one word that defined our childhood, and it was education, right? Oh, I scraped my knee. I fell off my bike. Well, did you go to school today? Oh my God, I fell off the slide. I think I broke my arm. How'd you do on the report card? The parents and the grandparents had a one-track mind. Do well in school.
That's so funny. You know, my wife is not an immigrant, but her dad is not an immigrant, and her grand, you know, but they have this immigrant mentality. And there's a whole story around my wife. You know, I was just mentioning before the show, we went to Europe last year, and we actually have connected with family, her family that didn't know she existed, right? So there's this aspect of a connection to people in a different country, and it's not immigrant. But when you say that about education, it reminds me of the first time that I met my father-in-law, but when we let him know, I didn't do things traditionally and go and say, hey, I work, you know, can I have your daughter's hand in marriage or whatever? Maybe I should have, but we were there together and we said, hey, John, you know, we're planning to get married. And he just stopped for a moment and he goes, looks at Brooke and he goes, you're going to finish school, right? It wasn't like, oh, congratulations. It was like, school's important. You know that, right?
I think, Jeff, what happens is for them, in their humility, that was the path to success. So it was the path to avoiding the grunt work. It was the path to avoiding the trenches. So I don't think my parents cared whether I went to architecture school or became a CPA or became a lawyer or became a doctor. I don't think they cared. So long as there was some sort of graduate degree involved, that was going to be my gateway to success.
Well, what was it like growing up then? Where did you grow up and what were the conditions? And because you're making me think of my father-in-law in a lot of, like, they grew up poor, quite poor in some ways. You know, he was weeding onion fields and throwing 100-pound sacks of sugar before he was like 12. What was your upbringing like?
I grew up in Brooklyn, and I think one of the formative experiences for me is my dad was an immigrant, and he came here when he was 22 years old, and he still had a strong connection to his family. So every mm-hmm. summer, either we would go as a family or he would send me to Sicily for the summers. And I got to tell you, being a young man and having both sets of grandparents there, not only are you surrounded with love, but you learn work ethic because you're on the farm. I mean, I don't care how old you are, you're contributing. So there's I remember there was one summer I left like a roly-poly kid and I came back like lean and mean and I had like muscles at 8 years old.
You've been working.
Yeah.
That's funny. Do you have siblings too? Or did you go over there with siblings?
Yeah, I'm the eldest. I have a sister who's 3 years younger and then I've got a little brother who's 15 years younger.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Did he grow up in the same with the same mentality?
No. Of course not. Upbringing? No. Very different. That's the irony, right? Because with immigrants, there comes work ethic, and with work ethic, there comes compound interest, and with compound interest comes success. So the mentality. I was born in '74, right? Mm-hmm. Is very different than the mentality maybe in the late '80s, early '90s, because then there's a little bit more creature comfort. So maybe we have two TVs in the house and the refrigerator is fuller. So things get relaxed a bit.
Yeah. Nope. That makes sense. I was born in 76. I have a brother who, my youngest brother, there were seven of us. He was born in 91. If I'm getting that right, it's 90 or 91. I'd have to stop and do the math. Yeah. He grew up differently than we did. Yeah. So for sure.
And I don't think it's a right or wrong. It's just, it's different. And it's they're both loving paths to the same goal.
Yeah. My oldest child and my youngest child might tell you they're right and wrong, but I'm not taking sides.
Well, with my three siblings, it was always the same debate. My two siblings would always call me the golden child, and me and my brother would call my sister daddy's little girl. And then me and my sister would always call my little brother, the favorite baby, right? So there's always that dynamic with siblings.
Well, and I, you know, my wife is from a Greek family, which is way more Greek than they should be, given the adoption of her grandmother in the United States and upbringing, you know, here. But they have a ton of Greek DNA to them. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's some similarities between the Greek DNA and the Italian DNA. Hope I'm not mischaracterizing that.
It's everything is the same except the breaking of the plates at weddings. Everything else is the same.
Yeah. So family is very important. Connection is important. And knowing your role, I think so. Well, so how did you go from, you know, summers in Sicily, working on the farm to where you're at today? What did that path look like for you?
High school. Go to college. I'm a graduate of St. John's University in Jamaica, Queens, also New York. I stayed local throughout. Went to mm-hmm. Brooklyn Law School. I'm a law school graduate. I don't practice, as you know, I don't practice, but I do lean on that JD. You know, there's mm-hmm. something interesting. Of course, you're the poster child for that, but there's something interesting that happens to you in law school. You have more of an analytical mind. Besides the reading of the contracts, it's also the linear analytical assessment of problem solving, of negotiations, of dynamics. So there's something interesting that happens. I got real deep into the world of real estate, I guess in my 20s. And that's where Matt and I met, because Matt was working for and then became partner at an investment banking firm. And we would meet in the canyons of the financial district. And there was a local watering hole there called Bobby Vans. And I remember the bartender would always say, "We're always busy because during good times, people need to celebrate. And during bad times, people need to commiserate." And that's where we met. And a lot of deals would happen over the course of a beer or a shot or whatever it may be. And when we formed our podcast, we called it aptly the Liquid Lunch Project, because it was an homage to those days where more deals happened over the course of a drink than in a Zoom room. And Jeff, frankly, I don't know which is right. I don't know which is wrong. But the romantic in me tends to think that that bar restaurant setting is a bit more apt for warm negotiations.
Yeah, no, I wish we, I don't drink necessarily, so I don't find myself in bars very often, but if we could sit down face to face somewhere for a bit, that would be fantastic.
Well, Jeff, this was my troubling dynamic, right? Because I played soccer and I played soccer competitively probably up until I was 30. So the idea of drinking for me was foreign. Like, I am not jeopardizing my performance, so I am not drinking. So these guys were all on their third, fourth rounds, and then they realized, is that a ginger ale? I think it gave me a slight competitive edge by fourth round in negotiating.
Yeah, that's funny. Do you still play by chance?
I do not. I tore my ACL years ago, and I probably see myself playing with my son because he's 2 years old now. So we'll run around at some point, but playing competitively is not. I've leaned more on cycling and tennis. It's less of a strain on the knees, believe it or not.
Yeah. Nope. I've done a little cycling, but I play tennis and soccer about 3 days a week each right now. They're
awesome,
my go-to sports. So I played soccer this morning.
Great. How'd you do?
It's friendly. I didn't hurt anybody and I didn't get injured. So it was a fantastic success.
Well, that's an ideal scenario. So if you could play in a championship game, what position would you play?
You know, I'm naturally a defender.
Okay.
So I play in the back. My foot skills are not, they're developing because we're playing a lot of futsal now.
But smart.
Yeah. It's fun. So I've gotten way more skills now than I ever had as a 17-year-old kid. But I'd be a defender still. You put me in that position. I just, I can't run too far outdoors or maybe too fast outdoors because I will pull my hamstring without a doubt.
Who are you rooting for next year's World Cup? If you have
a team. That's a great question. You know, I am a very, very, very casual fan of sports. If there's tennis on or soccer on, I'll probably watch it. But I don't have a whole lot of rooting going on.
So we'll root for USA by default.
Let's do that. If USA is playing, I will definitely root for them. I just don't know who's playing. So I was trying to avoid giving that away, but, you know, called me out on it. So, well, so now what you're doing, the Liquid Lunch Project podcast for your business. Tell me more about your business that you run. And it's you and Matt, and you have a larger team with you too, right?
Yeah. So Matt and I are principals, and I'm blessed to have a great partner in Matthew. Matthew Meehan has, as I mentioned earlier, he's got an illustrious Wall Street background. So he brought the investment banking expertise to the business. I brought more of the operational analytical side, and together we formed Shield Advisory Group. Now, clients tend to come to us for strategic purposes, whether they're acquiring a business or they're looking to expand or they're looking to franchise. And that one tool they always seem to lean on is working capital. Now, working capital in 2025 has become an art form more than a science, right? So let's get away from the big box shops, right? Because the big box shops are like one or two trick ponies. They either have a line of credit. And when I say big box, it's the JP Morgans, the Wells Fargos, the TD Banks, like the big boxes that these are basically cash banks. All they want to do is give you back your money at a 4-point margin. The reality is a client who needs working capital is better served with a more curated product that meets their needs. So for example, if you're in the construction field, you probably need some project financing to help you achieve that orbital thrust when the project is only paying you on 120 or 150 day terms. There's no reason to park a 20 year term loan on the books when you only need financing for 4 or 5 months. If you have a manufacturing company, you probably need a factor because that'll kick in once the deliverables start hitting, right? So it's a matter of curating the needs of the business that match the cash flow. And then that tends to create loyalty because you're highly respecting the business's cash flow and debt service vis-a-vis that loan product.
Yeah. And are those the type of companies that you typically see? Just the, you know, kind of everydays?
You would never hear, the typical small business owner would never know about these products. I mean, that's why we exist. We serve as that advisor liaison to try to find, like, I was just telling you earlier in the green room, like, we went to a conference last week just to meet more of these hybrid lenders. Like, you want these alternative solutions out there. I've come to the conclusion, Jeff, and it's an unfortunate one, that big banks do not like small business. One, it's not very profitable, and they tend to have a high rate of default or failure. Take those two elements, and suddenly it's not a very attractive product. I'd rather give a credit card out, or rather give a line of credit, right? It's a bit more secure.
Line of credit backed by your own money.
Exactly. It's exactly right.
Yes. Yeah, I've got a good friend who's just bought a business and structuring that, you know, pretty simple business, but every business has its intricacies. And he would call me, he'd be like, hey, do you know somebody for this? Or I'm working on this right now and I'm running into these problems. And, you know, he's an attorney, he's a smart guy, but still navigating the financing side of it. I imagine it's a lot easier if you've got millions of dollars sitting around to do that.
No, but Jeff, also, I don't think it's like intelligence and IQ has no relation here. There's no correlation between I'm a smart guy and I could find better solutions. It's almost like saying you and I cannot design your office, right? You need an interior designer. One, she or he may have some experience and they have more outlets and more experience in finding different solutions. Like maybe a longer conference room is better than an oval conference room, right? Experience has showed them that. And also they are exposed to all these vendors that are constantly selling them. And the same thing with us. You know, we're speaking to these lenders and there are new creative products coming out all day long. So when we find something that's really powerful, that would help small business, man, we add it to our arsenal and then we talk to our clients. And part of that is also training our advisory team, because the better knowledge they have about these products, the better that we can serve our clients.
Yeah, that all makes sense. And how do you guys get the word out about this? Because that was his issue. He's like, I've talked to this bank, I've talked to that bank. I need to find more people who have more solutions. And so I'd put him in touch with an independent broker, or I put him in touch with somebody I've done banking with, or, you know, I probably, if I had known, I would put him in touch with you guys at the time.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, you got to knock on a lot of doors, right? Look at us. I mean, we have a weekly newsletter that comes out every Friday on Substack, the weekly. We do our weekly podcast that we were blessed to have you on as a wonderful guest. That's one of our favorite episodes. We do email marketing. We have a call center. Like, there's no end. We go to marketing events. We go to expos. We go to conventions. You do anything to get the word out. So, yeah, I don't think there's one solution. Like, if you would have asked me that question maybe 8 to 10 years ago, I'd say it's Facebook ads and Google, Gmail, right? It's email marketing. I think those tactics are antiquated at this point, right? It's all bots and spam. So you have to kind of think outside the box today.
Yeah. And I'm sure that your newsletter and your podcast are helping kind of with that omni-channel approach to marketing. But that's one of the things that's always stumped me as I work with startups and smaller scaling companies. You know, some of these are investor-backed companies. I think that really the value to investors oftentimes isn't just the money. That can be helpful or hurtful sometimes, but it's the network that they bring to it, because they're in that game all day long and they can connect you with, you know, the right people at the right times. Whereas Main Street shops, mom and pop shops, may not have the same network access, right? So plugging into people in the financing world and the legal world oftentimes is—
Jeff, you're right. And part of it is educating them, right? Like sometimes when you're working with a startup, you're putting those documents and protocols in place to allow them to scale, whether it's intellectual property, whether it's copyright, you're allowing them to scale. And with us, how many times do we have conversations and say, well, look, this won't work today. However, over the course of the near future, respect these protocols and undertake these tasks, and you'll be in a great position come Q1 or Q2. Right. So it could also be there's nothing available today, but you're right around the corner.
Yeah. I'm curious to ask you, because you deal with so many companies, like, because I've been thinking about this in part as I was working with my friend on some stuff and in this business purchase, but also in my own small business that I run as a law firm and, you know, other clients I run with. What do you think that are the two or three or four metrics or characteristics that every small business owner needs to be managing? You know, is it profit and loss? Is it cash flow? Is it something else? What are those things?
I think it's real-time accountancy. So you need to be able to generate a profit and loss within a week or two. Like if I ask a business owner to generate a year-to-date profit and loss and it's dated August 31st, that's not a true metric because so much could have happened in those 2.5 months, right? So you need real-time accountancy. Besides real-time accountancy, you also need to measure cash flow. Like how much do you need coming in the door, and then respect that with accounts receivable. And another thing is I have a tough time with companies that do a lot of work on a timetable, whether it's, you know, 90 days, 120 days, 180 days, right? Because you're basically financing that work. And the one thing that business owners don't take into account, you laid out a lot of labor, maybe even materials to be able to do that work, and you're not getting paid for 120 days. There's a cost of that labor. There's a cost of that capital. Excuse me. And usually the pricing doesn't take that into account, right? So it's just understanding what it costs to open your doors every morning.
And that's interesting that you put that in terms of pricing. That is fundamentally a pricing issue. You got to get the price right to cover the cost. Otherwise, you've got a cost problem that you got to deal with. So
the trades are notorious for not estimating properly, nor billing properly.
Yeah,
because you're dealing with that human element, right? If that job required 3 visits instead of 2, and you only estimated for 2, well, there goes the profit margin.
Yeah, believe me, I know. As a law firm, where you know labor is the number one cost in the business.
Sure.
It's the same issue. So what are the tools that you see people using to deal with these factors? You know, real-time accountancy, cash flow, cost management. Are there tools out there that you're seeing that are commonly used? Or because I think when I talk to people, I'm like, oh, you don't know what cash flow is. You're not
tools, or the tools know. The tools don't matter. Tools do not matter at all. It's the data entry, right? So whether you use QuickBooks or whether you use Salesforce, there's so many wonderful programs out there today. Like in 2025, a small business owner has a plethora of tools at his or her disposal that are, I don't want to say free, but very, very user-friendly pricing.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a matter of the data entry. Why would a principal who's responsible probably for sales and management dedicate 4, 5, 6 hours a week for data entry on bookkeeping? Hire a bookkeeper. No, but they've got that myopic mentality where no one can do it as well as I can. Of course they can.
Yes, they can. They can do it better and cheaper and faster.
Exactly.
So, well, I'm curious to kind of turn the conversation a little bit because, and maybe either from the framework of the businesses you've worked with or your own business journey, you know, would love to explore maybe some of these moments in your business where it was those no gotcha moments, or can't believe that worked, or I didn't realize this, but once I figured it out, it really changed the business. Really the breakout moments in your journey. Have you had some of those along the way?
Yeah, but all out of the necessity and 911 mode.
Yeah.
I mean, we're pretty close in age, right? So we're children of the 70s, which means we've made enough mistakes to know what works, right? And I had my offices and businesses in Manhattan for years before I moved out to the suburbs. So you're victim of 9/11. On 9/12, we thought we were out of business, and we were for a few months. Now, in hindsight, there's clarity. But at the time, when you're walking through 6 inches of rubble, you don't know when you're going to reopen. And your mind starts playing games with you. I mean, do I close? Do I move? And you start going through this assessment. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, everything, the dust settles proverbially and physically, and you move on. And then there's the economic crisis of 2006, 2007, and you start all over again. And then again, I'm making this conversation very New York specific because that's where I was located. And then we had Superstorm Sandy. And don't forget, Manhattan is an island, and the island was flooded and everything came to a standstill. I mean, everything was halted for months. And you go through that same assessment. And then we go through the recession, and then we go through the pandemic again, right? So your mind almost develops this business callus. Mm-hmm. The callus of business in knowing to take a punch. And I guess a boxer has a better chin after 20 fights than after this first fight, right? You kind of learn to take a punch a little bit better. And I think a business owner must, by definition, be resilient. And I don't mean resilient where you let the stress roll off your shoulder. I mean, resilient in knowing how to pivot. I'll give you a perfect example. When the pandemic started, Matt and I looked at each other and every bank was closed. Every bank across the nation was closed. I mean, there was online banking, but nobody was underwriting loans because they didn't know how long this was going to last. Like, what's the debt service like? If the business is closed, how can they service the debt? So banks were closed. So we looked at each other like, what do we do? And then we started realizing the government was promoting all these tax credits. We said, well, you know what? Mm-hmm. Let's start offering tax credits. But what do we know about tax credits? So we took a big chance. We partnered with some accounting firms and we started offering our small business clients tax credits. And we thought it was a linear ancillary product, right? It was congruent to what we were offering. It was a tool for small business. And we did that for a couple of years and it kept the doors open for us. And thank God we had that insight. And then once everything reopened, now we have an additional revenue stream. Wow, this is great.
What did that take?
They give you lemons, you make lemonades.
Yeah, what did that take? Because you're right. These are all moments, and some are New York specific and some are global, and other people have other, you know, regional specific issues that they've dealt with.
Now, fortunately for us, the ERTC, the R&D, the WOTC, the WOTC, these were all national programs. So it fit within our marketing funnels and our outreach, and it resonated because you basically put liquidity in clients' pockets that they didn't have the wherewithal to achieve or even know how it worked.
But those aren't small undertakings, right? You've fortunately got the platform, you've got the kind of the machine in place, but you know, I've talked to a friend of mine who's in banking, a small regional bank, and yes, he helped build out their program, and it did wonderfully for them over time, but I know how hard he worked at it. Like, what went into that to build, or another thing like that? What goes into that from your team to build a new service offering? Because on the outside, we just see, you know, we see other businesses.
Yeah, it's all hands on deck 24/7 for a couple of weeks, right? Because you have to build out the flow. You've got to stress the flow. You have to work out all the kinks. And ideally, you do a soft launch, right? Just to kind of have maybe 10, 12, 20 pilot clients, just stress the system to see what works and what doesn't work. But then ultimately, you have to execute and you have to train your team literally overnight on new products. And that's not easy. What's the alternative? To close up shop? That's why I mean there's got to be resilience, right? There's something dangerous about a group that has nothing to lose, right? Let's go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you guys in that situation, do you think? I mean, did it feel that way to you when the pandemic hit? We pivot or we
Yeah, because no one's coming to the office. You couldn't open the office legitimately and nobody wanted to work, so you had to learn to work remotely and there were no meetings. And now that I think about it, at the time there were a lot of these small business networking groups and associations that flourished in Florida and Texas, the COVID adverse states. And I don't think it's any surprise that those states ended up blossoming thereafter because they were most business friendly during the pandemic.
Yeah. No, I remember our law firm, we had prior to that pandemic, we'd said, hey, let's structure everything so that we can work in a distributed way if we wanted to. We had an office. Most of the people came into it. But when COVID hit, we just stopped going to the office. We worked from home. We did all the same things we'd been doing. And I'd talk to clients. I'm like, how are you doing? And some of our clients, it's just devastating to them, right? Because it just impacted everything that they do on a day-to-day basis. And then people would ask me, how are you handling it? I'm like, I don't tell me people this right now in the moment because it's kind of the exact same as it was prior to the pandemic for us because we had put the infrastructure in place to work remotely.
Very
smart.
A
lot of our clients are distributed already. The nature of a lot of the law that we do, there's a lot of federal practice. And so it was easy to, we just didn't go to the office anymore and eventually got rid of the office. But I felt bad a little bit in a weird way. I'm like, I don't want to promote to the world how easy this has been for us because I know it hasn't been for everybody else. And the shakeup and the, you know, just the disruption and resilience was on everybody's mind there. So
I don't think that was luck on your part because you put the wheels in motion to be lucky. You saw or you or your partner saw that there was an alternative to that brick and mortar. I mean, the problem with the service space pre-pandemic was it was so top heavy because you needed a lot of real estate and you had heavy wages, right? So you just eliminated 50% of that equation. Kudos to you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, I think it's not for everybody. And I talked to owners and business owners, you know, I talked to somebody just last week, they run a 300 person business. They're adding another 80 this next year. And he said, we're an in-office, or I don't know if you call it in-office or office first. That's just how they operate.
Those so corner offices with a view and mahogany walls are pretty expensive.
They can be. Yes. Yeah. Well, so what are some of the insights that you've taken away from these moments where you're running into these issues? Or because I know it's not, you know, we always see the backside of it, right? Or I don't know if it's the front side, we always see the end result and it's like, oh, that worked out. You know, if the business, you probably wouldn't be talking about stuff if your business wasn't going right now, because, you know, you probably wouldn't be out there saying, well, look at everything that didn't work out for me, right? So you know, it's easy to hear all the good stuff.
I think the biggest takeaway and the biggest lesson learned there is to just start. People are obsessed, and business owners fall into this category. We are obsessed with getting things perfect. Let the market define perfect. So maybe the flow has 5 steps instead of 4. Or maybe that platform is a little tech amateurish. It's okay. You'll get there, right? Because something happens with the market. The market has a visceral reaction to whatever you're offering. And if it works, just double down and evolve with the process. Like, I'm certain that the Coca-Cola product today wasn't the same as it was 100 years ago, right? The viscosity was probably different. The ingredients are different. The important thing was just start it.
Okay, so how does, and you've got a background in strategy, right? You like to be, I think I read on your website, between you and Matthew, you know, you got funding and you got strategy. Do you think that comes into play in the way that you approach problems? I mean, do you and Matthew approach problems? You're coming at it with the same objectives, but do you come at it from the same angles, or do you guys come at things differently?
I'm certain you've heard this in the past, and the terms, Matthew is the visionary. He comes up with an idea, and then I need a couple hours to figure out if I can execute on that idea. And then sometimes I say, Matt, that is asinine. This is never going to work. But sometimes you'll have these ideas like, wow, I can scale that, right? Because how do you scale any product or service? Break it down to its umpteenth degree. And then times it by 10. If you break every task down to its minute detail, then it's easier to understand, and then you could scale that.
I mean, you've really simplified scaling. Do you see companies doing it that way? Are they scaling that simply, or are they trying to make it more complicated?
I think that is the aspiration of AI. Because if AI can help you expand and multiply your efforts, I don't think the key to AI is, oh, I have one person doing administrative work, let me fire that person and replace with AI. I think the hope for AI is that you'd be able to scale at such an accelerated pace and such an expansive manner that it becomes a game changer. So now you're able to punch way above your weight.
I haven't thought of it that way, but I think you're right, right? AI is, I don't know. I've used a lot of AI in different ways, and I'm trying to think if I've used it successfully to expand on something more than simplified. I think what I do is I use it to simplify, even if simplifying is getting the framework in place before expanding into, before adding my thoughts on things and
Jeff,
going outward from there.
AI lacks judgment. So you may use in your field, you may use AI to help you with the legal research, and you can help it pull some cases for you and just to see what prior cases said on that topic. But at the end of the day, it's your judgment that's going to help you decide which path to take or how to advise your client. So I think it's almost as if AI will help you organize your ingredients.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you have to execute on the cooking.
And judge whether or not it tastes good, right? So, well, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate your time here.
Then let's do it. Let's have some fun.
All right. So I'm going to start off with the easy one. You know, do you have a favorite book? Is that an easy one?
Yeah. You know what? I'm a big Ayn Rand fan. I love Ayn Rand. And so whether it's The Fountainhead or I think I'm just a voracious capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she's able to explain the free market mentality just resonates with me. Just okay. keep your eyes out of my bedroom, keep your hands out of my pocket, and let the market decide what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah. So on that note, what has worked this year for you? What's something where you're like, hey, we really nailed that?
Huh, interesting. In 2025, I think we did a really good job in improving our technology internally, right? Not just inter-office communications, because we have advisors and team members everywhere, all over the place. So being able to smoothly interact and share documents and share communications with everyone has always been a challenge. We've gotten much better and focused on that in 25. And it's 100% the success of our team, not Matt and I.
Okay. Yeah. Team is huge there. And so, if that's worked well in 2025, what's something you want to do with your business in 2026? Are you scaling? Are you optimizing? Are you cost cutting? Like, what are you doing in 2026?
We want to put fuel on the fire, right? The systems and processes are working. Communication is working. Our underwriting is working. The flows are working. We've got some wonderful dynamic lending partners. We just want to pour a lot of fuel on our fire.
Okay. And what is fuel funding or is fuel just more of this? You've nailed it. Now you're scaling it. Is that what it is? Or what is the fuel for you?
So scaling for us means a couple of things. One, more advisors. The more people we can speak to, the more business owners we can assist. Two, we have a lot of success with strategic affiliate partners. Affiliate partners by CFOs, CPAs. Big box banks, believe it or not, big box banks like us because they love to issue denials and declines, and someone's garbage is another person's treasure, and we
they do a service by giving somebody a referral to you guys after they tell them no.
Yeah, and we make them look good because they maintain the banking relationship, but they get the working capital that they needed. I mean, just because you have a 650 FICO doesn't mean you don't have a wonderful business. Okay. And the other theme is to try to go up market just a little bit, right? Just working with larger firms and larger enterprises.
What size of deals or firms does that equate to?
Basically, the same client base, just larger in scope. So if our target audience today is 2 to 25 million, we want to focus on that 2 to 40, 45 million.
Yeah. And that way you'll see maybe more deals or bigger deals along the way.
Yep. Because something tends to happen with inertia. That 1 to 3 year mark for businesses, you tend to have more failures. But once you get that forward momentum, it's easier for businesses to scale. They figured out the systems and processes. They figured out their products, their services. So it's easier to scale at that point.
Yeah. Okay, my last question is this, and I usually ask what are some tips for scaling CEOs, but I'm going to go a different direction with this based on conversation we've had. In addition to the importance of education, what is one lesson you'd like to teach your 2-year-old, you said, right?
Yes.
In the next 5 years?
Wow, what a wonderful question. I think the one thing I could teach James, my son, at a young age is work ethic. Because left to his own devices, someone can outsmart you and someone can out-strategize you. But if you decide, you could outwork everyone.
Yeah. Time to get a farm, I think. Or...
No, I hope
send
not
him to
for
Sicily.
I hope not for his sake. I got to figure out an easier way.
I don't know. It's tough to learn more work ethic than on a farm, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right, sir.
Well, Lou, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you spending some time with me. It's been good to reconnect since we spoke last on your podcast, and really glad that you've been willing to share some insights with our audience here on The Breakout CEO. So thank you so much for joining us.
Jeff, we thank you, and we love, love, love your firm. We love your platform. I can't express enough how important it is for small businesses to get their legal house in order. And traditionally, you'd have a very expensive retainer with an hourglass being turned over, and you've been able to crack the code and make legal services accessible to the masses. So thank you for what you do to the small business community. It's tremendous.
Well, that's very, very nice of you. I'm just trying to follow the footsteps and the paths of people like you who are also, they're catering to the same community. They're built, and you're making things accessible that need to be accessible. And, you know, my view is not to go off on a soapbox here, but you kind of open it up. You know, every small business needs to, you know, validate their product, validate their market, and then protect the freedom to operate their business. And that's where you and I come in, right? Legal, finance, the other administrative, maybe less sexy parts of the business that are there to make sure the business can run, operate, grow without failing legally, without failing financially. So I think we're
Jeff,
doing the same good work.
I will say the same thing in a much less eloquent fashion. Let the candlestick maker make candles. Let the shoemaker shine shoes. Let the mechanic work on cars, right? Leave all the administrative muck to firms like us. We'll handle it for de minimis cost.
That's right. Yep. Let the business owners go and do the thing that they wanted to do in the first place, that they thought was running a business and selling stuff and making some money. Lou, thank you again. Tell Matthew hi for me. And to all of you guys who joined us here today on this episode, thank you. Feel free to leave a review if you enjoyed this podcast. Send guests and send listeners our way. We love building up the community of startups and scaling CEOs. And glad you joined us again. And we'll see you again next episode.
Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.